My guest today is Catherine Ellis, CEO of Leadership Victoria, an innovative independent social enterprise that has a shared vision of purposeful leadership for an inclusive, equitable, and sustainable society. Catherine has over 30 years of leadership experience across the private, public, and not-for-profit sectors, and a strong track record of developing leaders and connecting them across sectors to achieve collective impact. She has worked in London as Director of Youth Affairs at the Commonwealth of Nations, focused on youth empowerment and leadership policy and programs across 53 countries. Among her various qualifications, Catherine holds a Master's in Public Administration from Harvard Kennedy School and a Master's in e-business. However, she regards her graduation from Leadership Victoria's flagship Williamson Community Leadership Program as a pivotal point in her life. Without further ado, let's delve into what motivated Catherine to pivot to the development sector, despite having what others might perceive as exciting roles. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to Atlanta Diaries.
Hi, Inma. It's lovely to be here. And thanks for the opportunity to talk with you.
I'd love you to describe your childhood and what ways do you think it played a role in shaping the person that you've become?
Thanks for that question, because it does actually resonate hugely with me, because my childhood and my family in particular have been very influential in who I've become and how I've lived my life. I have a friend who said to me once, "I hope you realise when families were handed out, you were at the front of the line."
Oh,
and
that's amazing.
I do feel very fortunate that to have come from a family of a level of privilege, not wealth privilege, we're not, you know, comfortable, but not wealthy in any way, but very much stable and supportive and believing in the importance of education and fairness and lots of love. And I've been really grateful for the sort of level of self-esteem it gave me that helped me withstand being bullied at school, because I never really understood why they were bullying me, because I didn't understand. I never did anything to them. And so it really didn't kind of affect me in the way it can quite often. And my parents also have very strong values. My mum was a community organiser, a volunteer, and my dad had a very strong moral compass. So I picked up strong values of social justice and integrity from them. And I also had lots of opportunities. My mother had this belief that if she kept all of us kids very busy, we couldn't get in trouble. And so she would sign us up to all kinds of things. And as a result, you know, I tried lots of things, and it really created a sense of curiosity in me about trying new things, and I guess a level of confidence in doing that as well. Years later, I did the VIA Character Strengths Survey, and I wasn't surprised that my top strengths came out as social justice and curiosity about the world.
It's actually one of those tools which focuses on what you have rather than what you need to become. So I totally love that tool. Yeah. You know, sort of, I heard bullying and, you know, wondering why me. Tell us a little bit about that. And how did then that influence probably you finding your North Star?
Yeah, I think I feel very fortunate that I'm not a young person today, honestly, because today bullying is 24/7. But back in when I was a child, obviously social media didn't exist. And so it was at school or sometimes, you know, at girl guides or sport, whatever circumstances. But I was always able to come home to a safe space and quite often just lose myself in books. I read a lot as a kid. But what I've realized over the years is that people who bully others, generally it's because they've got some deficit they're trying to cover up or deal with. And I think if I had to go back now and be a child again, I'd be much better at kind of addressing that with those people. But at the time, I just was confused, to be honest. And it actually helped me develop a sort of sense of resilience. I think I made myself small, so I tried to be careful about how smart I would let people know I was. And it was really actually when I was 17 and I finished high school and I went to Japan as an exchange student that changed everything. There were, I think, there were 15 of us in the town I was in, and so we all did a lot of things together as well as going to our individual schools and hang out with our Japanese classmates. And for the first time ever, I felt like I'd kind of found my people, because they were also kind of bright, high-achieving young people, and we were there because of that. And it was almost like we had permission to be ourselves and be big, you know. And it's the first time in my life I ever experienced being popular at school as well, and that was a quite an extraordinary revelation to me too. And I think that it can be really damaging for kids to experience bullying in ways that they need to feel that they have to change themselves or become less than who they really are. And I know that in my years in working in the youth sector over the last 20 years, you know, I've seen that a lot of the work that the organisations I've been involved in do is unpacking that with young people and giving them a sense of safety and space and appreciation for the person they are, as, you know, unusual as they might be. And in fact, celebrating that weirdness and that unusualness, because those are the people who actually make the world really interesting. And they're the people who quite often go on and do brilliant things in the world.
I actually sort of did like an introductory call with this young girl. She's all of 14 years old in India, and she was a victim of a lot of bullying. She started her own little startup, an app for anti-bullying. And she was actually given some early funding by Shark Tank recently, you know. So I think it's just all about how you sort of see that as a strength. Very interesting. And thank you again for sharing all this, Catherine. Japan. So I'm just very curious to know, how come Japan became your choice of exchange program?
So I grew up in Brisbane, and at that time in the 80s, there were many, many Japanese tourists coming to Australia, particularly to Brisbane, to go to the Gold Coast and to the koala sanctuary. So a lot of schools started offering Japanese. And at my school, you actually had to do French, German and Japanese, all three languages. And surprisingly, I found I really loved Japanese. And so I did it right through into my senior year. And I applied for a Rotary Exchange scholarship that year. Again, my mother saying, here's an opportunity that would be great for you. And I nearly actually went to Sweden, because they decided that I was pretty resilient and Sweden was known as a quite challenging country. And there was a guy from the Rotary Club that had nominated me, who said, hang on, we have places in Japan. She speaks Japanese. She wants to go to Japan. Why would we send her to Sweden? And so thank you to that guy, whose name I can't even remember anymore, I ended up in Japan for a year in a city called Gifu in the middle of Japan. And it was such a wonderful year. It was so fascinating culturally. And it really instilled a lifelong love of Japan in me, and travel generally, actually. And I did all the sorts of subjects that I couldn't do in Australia, because I was trying to get a high entry score for university. So I did art and sewing and things like that. And I grew enormously as a person in my confidence. So when I came back to Australia, certainly the person inside me had come out through that year.
Sounds so fascinating. So some, you know, key lessons or stories in that 1 year. Did you go back in between, or was it like a full stretch of 1 year?
No, it was a full year. And I called my parents once a month, because it was very expensive to call Australia. Obviously no internet in those days. So you were really, really, you know, separated from your family and your life at home. And I think that was wonderful. I actually kind of think it's a shame for young people when they travel now that they don't have that full immersion experience. And obviously it can be hard as well. But I loved the language for a start. So I put a lot of effort into learning the language. And Japan was such a dichotomy at that point, well, it still is, I guess, where you've got all this amazing cultural history, but then also the modern technology side. And I really immersed myself in that life. And I had all these different mannerisms that when I came home, I had to undo again, because that didn't work for an Australian. But I guess it really boosted my confidence and boosted my sense of myself, and the need I think we all have to be passionate about our lives and things that we're interested in.
Absolutely. And you said you kept on returning to Japan multiple times.
So I actually got a job at World Expo 88 in Brisbane in the Japan pavilions. So I got a trip to Japan through that. And at the end of my first 3 years of university, I won a Qantas scholarship. And so I went back to Japan for a few months over the Christmas holidays as a student again. And then when I got my first real job in the private sector, so I loved who I was when I was in Japan, and I loved the culture and the experience of it. So I kept wanting to go back. And that meant that I built quite a lot of resilience, particularly after I graduated from university. I went and worked there for 6 months, mostly actually to make enough money to go traveling in Europe, to be honest. But I had to live in some pretty sort of straitened circumstances, including, you know, sleeping on the floor of people's bedrooms and things, just because I was trying to save money. And it's actually quite difficult to get accommodation in Japan. And so I was doing a lot of couch surfing. But again, you know, that sort of experience it does make you makes you tougher. It makes you appreciate what you have. And if you're doing it because you can see a goal that you want to pursue, which for me at that time was traveling in Europe, then it's worth it.
Shifting gears, Catherine, let's talk about your experience in the private sector.
Yeah, well, those 12 years in the private sector, I don't regret them at all. I learned how an organization can be run really, really well. And I was able to take that learning into the social sector and do the kind of work that I've done ever since. It also meant that I earned enough money that I was financially stable, which meant I could shift sectors and take a salary cut, which is very hard for a lot of people. I guess through your 20s and 30s, it can be quite pivotal in terms of the kind of career you pursue, but also the kind of person that you become. And I think that having the different opportunities within the private sector meant that I learned a lot about what I was good at and what people will want from you because of that, and how to sort of walk the path that's right for you without, destroying any of those relationships as well.
So, Catherine, do you think you knew from get-go that you're going to eventually move out of the private sector?
No, don't think so. It was a gradual process, and I didn't even really understand what it was. I just knew it, well, I wasn't satisfied, and I kept thinking maybe it's the job, maybe it's the company, maybe it's the people I work with. And so I actually did a lot of different jobs through that time, and they were interesting jobs, and I got a lot out of them, and I learned an enormous amount, but there was just always something missing. And I did start to look for sort of meaning outside work, and I did some mentoring of young people, and eventually I took on the corporate social responsibility role at my company. And through that role, I was really fortunate to work with a wonderful woman called Jo Cavanna, who ran a social services organization nearby. And she then encouraged me to think about applying for a job that had been newly created at a youth development organization called the Reach Foundation, which I did. And that was the point where my life really shifted. And I was exactly what they needed at the time, and they were exactly what I needed at the time. And it went on from there.
You said even if you change a lot of jobs, you did get clarity on what you are good at. Right? So what does that mean?
So I think what I've realized over the years is that I'm a very good generalist. So I have a systems view, and I can see where there are gaps in that system. So having a job in the private sector where I moved regularly to different parts of the organization to work on them allowed me to really develop that systems level approach to work. And I also developed a real kind of interest, and maybe I already had it, I'm not sure, in fixing those gaps and coming up with solutions and then innovating as well. So I think a lot of the skills that I learned in a patchwork way in the private sector, I was able to bring together in a really cohesive way when I moved to the social sector, probably because I was working in much smaller organizations, and therefore I had the ability to work right across the organization.
Let's shift gears and talk about the development sector. So, how did it sort of start? What was the pivotal point? Take us through that journey.
Yeah, so when my friend Jo suggested that I look at this organization, she put me in touch with Jim Steins, who was one of the founders. He was a football star, and he invited me to come along and watch one of the big workshops that they ran called Heroes Days. And I walked in, and the first thing I noticed was that people were really friendly. People were like, "Oh, hi, come on in." And whereas the company I was working at, if someone didn't know you, then they just wouldn't talk to you. Even if you were sitting in reception, no one would pause to see if you were okay or anything like that. And I sat there through that workshop and watched these people facilitate this group of 500 teenagers, creating a space that was really fun and energetic, and using music and drama and all kinds of experiential activities, but at the same time creating a really safe space where young people felt that they could share themselves. And they had a particular target actually on sort of tapping into the tough kids in the group and getting them to share openly, which would create firstly an environment where the rest of the kids were mesmerized by hearing, the tough kids, the bullies, the popular rock star kids of the group being really vulnerable and sharing. but also actually creating a pathway for some of those young people to be different from the persona that they had come to be known by in their school. And it was quite extraordinary work. And I remember thinking, wow, I want to work for this organization. And so I did. And when it all worked out really nicely. And I was there for 5 years. And, it was a pretty fledgling organization at that time. And so I was able to bring a lot of my private sector knowledge and strengths in and improve the structure and the rigor and the kind of awareness of how the organization should run really effectively, at the same time being very careful not to mess up the essence of that organization and the work itself. I also sort of really took a long look at, well, how do we scale up this work? And part of that was actually about creating jobs within the organization for the young people who led the programs. Most of the work was actually designed and delivered, led by young people themselves, aged between about 16 and 25. So that was a really pivotal thing for me as well. I found also that there was a gender imbalance very much because the two founders were men. A lot of the people who were supporting the organization were men. And the two founders had come out of quite male-dominated industries as well. So one was a footy star and the other one was a film director. And so in their kind of worlds, women were fairly utilitarian. And there were these fantastic young women leaders in the programs who weren't getting the opportunity to lead the programs. So I started kind of agitating around that. And I remember one of the founders saying to me, oh, yeah, but the girls can't hold the room. And I said, oh, I'm pretty sure they could. And one of the things I put in place was that every program had to have a male and female. It was before we were very conscious of non-binary young people as well, facilitators. And it meant that the young women actually then got many more opportunities and, in fact, started to really shine and started to really take over. And they were the ones coming up with all the new ideas for new programs. And then I had to sort of step back and start supporting the young men more because the pendulum had swung too far the other way. So it's something really important you can do as a leader to be looking at the diversity and the balance within your team and that young women are getting opportunities, and also recognizing that they need to put their hand up for those opportunities. They can't just sit back and wait for them to be handed to them just because they work hard and do well. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And did this sort of lead to then the Williamson Community Leadership Program, Catherine?
Yes and no. So I had had my eye on the Williamson Community Leadership Program for some time, and I'd actually applied and had not got in. So it was my first experience, I think, ever of not achieving something that I'd put my mind towards. But I actually did the Williamson Program in my last year at Reach. One day, one of the young women who I was talking about came to me with a new idea, and it was a really great idea. And I was very excited for her, but I was also thinking, oh my God, and that's just more work for me. And it made me realize that I was probably plateauing a bit, losing my freshness a bit. And I've learned over the years now to recognize that in myself when I feel like that, because that's usually a signal that it's time for me to start looking for something new. But I did get into the program that year with sort of 35 to 40 other high potential mid-career leaders from the private sector, not-for-profit, government, academia, etc. And over the year, you hear from lots of different seasoned leaders about real challenge for them in their leadership and how they dealt with it, what they learned from it. And it was very similar to the experience that I'd had when I was an exchange student. And you'd be very surprised to know that the most insightful piece of leadership advice I got, or information I got during that program, was from a football coach. Because something he said about the way he had left his organization really made me take a step back and think about what I was doing at Reach and how, if I was going to leave there, I needed to do it in a way that allowed me to come back and enjoy the successes later, and that I could leave it in really good shape for the next person to come in and take over. Another one was actually the Chief Police Commissioner at the time, who was one of the speakers, and she talked about how she had gone to Harvard and what a difference that had made to her career. And again, I remember sitting there thinking, that's it. That's what I need to do next. Because for me, to leave Reach was such a huge step because I'd had such a wonderful time there. And I had grown so much as a person, as a leader. One of the real strengths of Reach and its work is focused on empathy and actually understanding what is going on for people beyond the behaviour that they're exhibiting. And I had learnt to do that much more effectively and had brought that into my leadership as well. And then that's when I heard about this mid-career master's program at the Harvard Kennedy School. And so I applied. And again, you know, another thing that I learned at Reach was to share your ambitions, share your hopes with people, because in the past I would have applied for that, but applied for it secretly and not told anybody. But instead, I said to everybody, I'm going to be leaving. I'm applying to this master's program. If I don't get in, then I'm going to go traveling anyway because it's time for me to leave Reach and, you know, have a new stage to my career and my life. And so the day that I did get in, I was able to go and say, I got in, and everybody celebrated with me. And it was so much better than if I had kept that to myself for fear of failing. Anyway, yeah, so then I did go off to Harvard and had probably the best year of my life. It was wonderful. Yeah.
Awesome. So you said early on that I sort of decided that I'm going to talk to everyone about my plans. So how did you change that perspective? Because there was a chance that you might not make it, right?
Yeah. So I'm very big on the importance of continuing to grow and learn and find new opportunities that come along. But I've usually done it in quite a quiet way because I didn't want to be exposing myself and making myself vulnerable to people laughing at me or criticizing me if I didn't succeed in that. But what I learned at the Reach Foundation is that actually sharing your vulnerability can be an incredibly powerful thing. And in fact, the more you can share struggles you've had yourself, the more you can actually help and inspire other people to who are often dealing with the same kind of struggles. So I decided to walk the talk and let people know. And it really paid off. And it was such a learning for me.
Why the idea of vulnerability resonates with me. But also sometimes, you know, when you're younger, vulnerability can backfire, right? In hindsight, of course, it's good. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, actually, vulnerability can be very dangerous if it's not exercise carefully. As you say, for young people who maybe aren't in a power position. I think also if people don't have supports around them, and I know that for me, I've always had the comfort that if everything went really wrong, I could just go home and move back in with mum for a while and it would be fine. And not everybody has that privilege. So it is really important to understand when and where to exercise vulnerability. But I'd say the other side of that coin is for everybody to be thinking about how they respond to someone who is being vulnerable with them and that they take care with how they engage with that person and accept that gift that is being offered to them of that person really sharing something very vital and very terrifying probably for them.
Yeah, we talk about a utopic world, you know. And the reason I asked this question is because a lot of my clients, as they sort of discover their leadership style, recognize that vulnerability is important, but they also recognize that not all organizations are able to give that safe space. So I think it's a fine line between deciding when to sort of start being vulnerable or watch the situation and then decide whether you can be vulnerable or not.
Yeah, there's a lot of work being done now on making organizations psychologically safe. And I think that will play a huge role in people feeling that they can bring their whole self to work, that they can be vulnerable, and that they can talk about their aspirations in ways that are not seen as, you know, overambitious or inappropriate or anything. So that as leaders, we can be identifying people who have aspirations, who we might want to support to go forward. When I was at the Reach Foundation, one of the sort of ways we described the organization was about supporting young people to dare to dream. But I would often get young people coming to me and saying, but I don't know what my dream is. And I think we need to be careful about also creating this expectation that everybody knows where they're going in life.
True.
And really supporting people to understand that it's okay to be uncertain. It's okay to not know where you're going to end up, you know, in 20 years' time, but to really continue to grow, continue to learn, continue to connect with other people so that when opportunities do come along, you can identify them and take them up, or identify them and decide this is not for me, and progress through your life and your relationships and your profession in ways that are right for you.
Yeah, again, it takes you to those safe spaces, right? Which allow you to sort of be yourself rather than being judged by everybody is probably the biggest takeaway in this conversation. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's been interesting for me in my most recent job where, I have got very used to working in environments that are psychologically safe and where people sharing their vulnerability is okay. And particularly my last job at the Youth Affairs Council of Victoria. And I found actually that at one point I was sharing too much because I was trying to be transparent about what was going on in the organisation. And I was actually making people worried about things. And I didn't mean to do that. I was just letting them know what was happening with full confidence that I was going to look after that particular issue, but realizing that actually by sharing too much, I was creating stress in the group. So it is definitely an art just as much as it is a science.
Yep. And this really takes me to how do you think your leadership style evolved over the years? Probably, the question was, is it lonely on the top?
Yeah, you have to find people. That's the thing. And I mean, some people have a partner who is their sounding board and who they download to when they need to. I don't have that. But what I have created over the years are connections with other people who are in similar kind of leadership roles and actually creating those spaces where you can share with each other the struggles that you're facing and get advice that is well-meaning and not going to come back and bite you in any way. So actually now it's more than 10 years ago, I had lunch with a group of other women who were also CEOs of not-for-profit organisations. And we were just actually having a social lunch, but we ended up talking about a lot of the challenges we were facing and what we were dealing with. And as you say, very lonely at the top. And at the end of the lunch, we said, oh, this is great. We should do this all the time. And so we had a couple more lunches. And then I actually went off overseas for 6 years and worked in London. And when I came back, I found that it was a group, probably now 50 or 60 women who are leading not-for-profit organizations that just come together every few weeks. That kind of thing is so critical in this kind of space where you are facing challenges which are not easy and not regular either. And this is where you ask me how my leadership has changed over the years. In my early career, I was about solving problems through technical solutions. Whereas what I've realized and learned over the years, and I did study this at Harvard as well, is the importance of being an adaptive leader, where you are actually understanding what is going on for the stakeholders in the system and how any change you might try to make can have ripple effects on other people and what that might lead to, and be thinking about all of that context as you are making decisions and leading going forward. So it's a very complex space that I think in the early days as a leader, you don't even know what you don't know.
Yeah. You also mentioned early on that you did tend to get restless after a few years in your role. So I'm just wondering what factors typically contributed to this restlessness. And the reason why I asked you this question is because I think somebody like you then as a leader would probably see that in others too, and probably be that mentor to them, especially given that your whole work is in the space of leadership.
Now it is, yes. But I think my sweet spot is organizations or within a big organization, a division that has a really great track record or great product, but has problems and is not realizing its potential. And, I also really like to innovate, as I said before. And so I guess what it comes down to is I like to fix organizations up and then grow them. I'm not good at startups. I've tried a couple of those, and I think it's also good to know what you're not good at. But once an organization is running smoothly, then I start to get restless because I like that sort of analytical challenge around, okay, what's going on here and what do we need to do to make it better? So each time I've changed jobs, generally it's because I've been feeling that restlessness. And if I get that restlessness, I've also learned it's not very good for me and it's also not very good for the organization I'm leading. And, the upside of it is that it leads to new adventures. I wouldn't have done half the things I've done in my career if I hadn't had that sort of sense of rest. So sometimes I've had staff who are not doing well in a role, and I've actually found by talking with them about what it is that they are enjoying or not enjoying, or even I can just see it, actually moving them into a different role has allowed them to flourish and be really successful. So it's actually about working out what is it that's going to really make them flourish. Sometimes you also do have to move people on, and that's one of the hard parts of leadership. And done that as well, and it's hard. And but really being very true to your values and understanding that the reason I'm doing this is because it's good for the organization, which at the end of the day is good for the people who we serve, is what can really get you through that kind of challenging circumstance as well.
Talk to me about when you had to take some tough decisions and a heartwarming story in your leadership journey.
Okay, all right. I'll tell you a couple of stories from when I was at the Commonwealth of Nations. It was kind of my dream job. It was youth development in an international development context. Amazing. And I got there and found that there was a structure that had been in place for 30, 40 years and couldn't be afforded anymore by the budget. And there was no scope to increase the budget. So I had to go through a process of completely restructuring the youth division, which included closing four regional centres in India, in Chandigarh, actually, in Zambia, Solomon Islands and Guyana. And part of that meant making people redundant who had worked for the Commonwealth for years, and also young people who thought that they had a lifelong career there. And so I went through quite a lengthy process, set up a working group with members from the High Commissions in London and some of the technical experts from the Commonwealth Secretariat. We also had to work fairly speedily, though, because the budget situation was pretty dramatic. And that meant travelling around to all of those regions and letting them know personally, which was very, very challenging, including the host governments of those centres, because they were very upset also that the centres were going to be closed. Also, how do we actually make sure that these facilities, which were owned by the host governments, were retained for the benefit of young people and weren't just absorbed into some other part of the government or something. So negotiating around that. So it was a very tough time, probably one of the toughest times in my career. And I really felt for all these people who were so proud of being part of this organization and doing this work. But I was also very, very clear that it had to happen because there was no way we would have be able to have any impact otherwise. And so at the end of that, we restructured and we had a much smaller team, mostly based in London, but we were able to then partner with lots of different governments and run activities in Tanzania and in Samoa, and all the countries of the Commonwealth were now benefiting from this program and their young people were. So it was very tough and it took a lot of resilience to sort of stick the course. We did end up in a good place.
And what about a heartwarming story?
Well, one of the things that that big project then enabled us to do, it freed up some budget that we were able to then go on and do different activities. And I was really keen to create a young professionals program at the Commonwealth. So as part of the restructure, I created eight positions in my division that were to be filled by young people from across the Commonwealth. And then my fellow directors were like, we'd quite like some of those young people ourselves. So we ended up with about 25 roles across the organisation where we recruited young people from Commonwealth countries for two-year contracts in London. And a lot of those young people had got jobs at the World Bank and Facebook and the Aga Khan Foundation and all kinds of places. So that was a really great thing to see. But what that also led to, which is actually we were able to form these Commonwealth youth networks where young people who were leading in their own countries, in Guyana and Zambia and Kenya and places, around issues like climate change and health and education and peace building, were able to come together and connect across the Commonwealth and therefore influence more at the UN and places where policy decisions were being made about young people, but also about the issues that they were focused on as well. And I think that was a really important thing, firstly, because it gave a platform for those young people that they wouldn't normally have got, because quite often people who live and work in developing countries find it very hard to get a voice at a global level. And the UN started collaborating with us because we had access to all these amazing young people from developing countries. They wanted to bring them into the UN programs too. And what it also meant was that those young people were actually able to have impact on issues that were not just about young people, but that were about the world itself. Obviously, peace building has a big impact for young people, but it has a big impact for everybody. And so it gave them a way of demonstrating that young people should be involved in all decision making because their lives and everybody else's lives are affected by the work they do.
So powerful. You know, Catherine, little out of context question, you know, your work was so powerful and like you said, something which impacts anyone and everyone. Having said that, did you find it challenging or concerning that salaries and benefits in the private or corporate sector versus the development sector are not comparable?
It was certainly an issue for my father when I first moved from the private sector to the Reach Foundation. He was very, very worried that I was throwing my career out the window. But I said to him, no, I actually think that this will be great for my career. I mean, definitely it's a pay cut, but it wasn't such a pay cut that I couldn't survive. But what it did do was it gave me what I call intangible income and be at the table when incredibly interesting things were being discussed. And I guess for people who are very driven by money and ambition, maybe it wouldn't have been the right decision, but for me, it definitely was. And it really came home to me actually through the COVID crisis when I was CEO of the Youth Affairs Council of Victoria. So we had some really terrible bushfires in Victoria in January 2020. And then COVID hit a couple of months later. And so being CEO of the Youth Affairs Council of Victoria at the time, which is the peak body for the youth sector, it meant that I was sitting at the table with the health department. I was talking to the ministers about how young people were being affected. And so that intangible benefit for me of being able to really be in a space to make a difference in the world actually makes up for the lower salary in a lot of ways. Having said that, I would also say that I think it's really important to understand that people with really great qualifications and skills go into the social sector, into development, and to not expect that they should be paid properly for those qualifications and those skills, I think is disrespectful for a start. But it also actually is detrimental to the organisations that they work in because they either won't come in the first place or they will burn out. Or they will move on because they eventually can't sustain the life that they want to lead. And we see that quite a lot in the social sector with young people who are very passionate in the early days, and then suddenly they start to have kids or they need to get a mortgage and they can't afford to stay in the sector anymore and they have to go and get jobs in other places and we lose them from the sector. And that's tragic.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. And I also often reflect as, you know, since I'm so involved with Jai Vakil, which is another not-for-profit, that why should we hold it against people if they're doing even more meaningful work?
And it's also linked very much to the expectation of funders, so philanthropists, government, corporate sponsors, et cetera, that organizations in the not-for-profit sector should not have high overhead costs. And so they want us to run with, 10% overhead. And it's just unrealistic.
Before we end the conversation, what advice would you like to give to emerging leaders looking to make impact across the sectors?
Being curious about what is going on and how can I learn and what can I contribute and how do those things connect together and who are the people, who are the players in this? Keeping on top of that constantly, I think, is incredibly important. And then, along with that, looking for the opportunities where you can contribute. I quite often advise people from the private sector who come to me saying, I want to make a change, I want to go and run a not-for-profit. I say to them, think carefully about that because it's not as easy as you think, and you actually could do far more good staying where you are in your well-paid job in the private sector and actually volunteering and using your influence within your organisation to make sure that your organisation does better for people and the community and the environment. So you don't have to change jobs in order to have that impact. And you have to look after yourself because it's hard work. It's much harder working in the not-for-profit sector. And I mean, I had a massive learning curve when I came across because I was a typical arrogant private sector person. I thought I knew everything. I was going to teach these people how things should operate, make them effective and efficient. And it was a massive learning curve for me. So for emerging leaders who are looking to have an impact across diverse sectors, I would say look at the impact you can have where you are. And that can actually have a ripple effect to other sectors. Because of the way you treat your employees, because of the way you run your business, because of the donations you make, the volunteer time you give. If you're in government, because of the policies that you're making and the efforts you're making to engage with and understand the people who are affected by those policies. There's a lot of ways that you can have an impact on people beyond your sector by working well within your sector. And then if you feel you really do want to make a move, then talk to a lot of people about the best way to do that before you do. And I say that as somebody who didn't do it particularly carefully and had to learn along the way and was very, very lucky to have mentors around me who supported me in that.
So, Catherine, share some examples of how you've supported and guided emerging leaders and the impact you've seen as a result of those mentorship efforts.
I've been very lucky through my career to have sponsors along the way. Mentors, definitely, yes, but also sponsors. And I think they're incredibly important and underrecognized. They're the people who usually are more senior in your organization or sometimes outside your organization who can see you as a talent and want to help you progress in your career, quite often for their own benefit, but that's okay. And so, you know, I think that where I've had senior people say, I think you should put Catherine on this project, or why don't you put Catherine into this role, has really helped my career along. And I actually think it's one of the reasons where we have the gender imbalance into leadership roles, because leaders tend to support the people who remind them of themselves. And as long as we've got mostly white men in leadership positions, that's going to perpetuate. So I think there's a real responsibility for those of us who are in leadership roles and roles of influence and responsibility, whether we're white men, white women, people of colour, people with disability, whatever our identities and our attributes are, that we're actually spotting right across our organisations and outside our organisations, people who, with a bit of support and a hand up, can really actually thrive in their careers. And so many talented young people out there who don't have the social capital that helps them to take those steps upwards in their career means that there's an enormous amount of talent that's being unrealized that could be going towards making this world a better place.
Yeah, that's a beautiful perspective. Sponsor your own tribe. One tends to think that why should I sponsor my own tribe? You know, let them also learn the hard way. And what you're saying is recognize it and let it perpetuate. Give them that platform.
Yes. I would say be very careful that it doesn't swing over into sort of favoritism or nepotism or anything like that.
Yeah.
Where there's genuine talent, there is nothing wrong with recognizing that and giving them an opportunity or asking someone else to give them an opportunity if you're worried about it looking like favoritism.
Thank you, Catherine. You've given a lot of perspectives to the development sector, and I think it'll give people lots to think about.
My pleasure. It's lovely speaking with you, Emma. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for being a part of this incredible journey with Atlanta Diaries. I have had the privilege of hosting guests who courageously shared their most vulnerable selves with me. And even if only a small segment of these conversations can champion the journey of one person, it will be worth each and every moment. And together, we know we can create an even greater impact. So I do have a humble request for you. If you found value in these episodes, please consider sharing the podcast with your friends, family, and on your social media. I would also love to hear your thoughts and will really appreciate if you could take a moment to leave a review or rating. See you next week for another inspiring journey on Atlanta Diaries. Thank you.